The guests at Lady Sybil's tea party were leaving when Vimes got back to the hall. He scraped the countryside off his boots and headed to the hall's master bathroom. Of course, there were plenty of bathrooms around the place, probably more than there were in a street in most of the city, where a tin bath, a jug and basin, or nothing at all, were the ablutions of choice or necessity. But this bathroom had been built to a design by Mad Jack Ramkin, and resembled the famous bathroom at Unseen University, although, had Mad Jack designed that one, it would have been called the Obscene University, since Mad Jack had a healthy, or possibly unhealthy, liking for the ladies, and in his bathroom it showed, oh dear, it showed. Of course, the white marble lovelies were dignified with urns, bunches of marble grapes, and the ever-popular length of gauze, which had happily landed in just the right place to stop art becoming pornography. It was also, in all probability, the only bath that had taps marked hot, cold, brandy. And then there were the frescoes, such that if you were a man easily persuaded, then it was a good job there was a cold tap, because not to put too fine a point on it, as it were, there were a large number of fine points all over them, yes indeed, and the ladies were only the start of the problem. There were marble gentlemen as well. Definitely gentlemen, even the ones with goat's feet. It was surprising that the water in the bath didn't boil of its own accord. He had asked Sybil about it, and she said that it was an important feature of the hall, and gentlemen collectors of antiquities would often visit in order to inspect it. Vimes had said that he expected that they did. Oh, yes, indeed. Sybil had said there was no need for that tone of voice, because she had occasionally taken a bath there from the time she had been 12, and had seen no harm in it. It had, she said, stopped her from being surprised later on. And now Vimes lay in the luxurious tub, feeling as if he was trying to fit all the bits of his brain together. He was only vaguely aware of the bathroom door opening, and of hearing Sybil say, "I've put young Sam to bed, and he's sleeping soundly, although I can't imagine what he might be dreaming about." Then Vimes floated again in the warm, steamy atmosphere, was only just aware of the swish of cloth hitting the floor. Lady Sybil slid in beside him. The water rose, and so, in accordance with the physics of this business, did the spirits of Sam Vimes. A few hours later, almost drowning in the pillows on the huge bed, and floating just above unconsciousness in a warm pink glow, Sam Vimes was certain that he heard his own voice whispering to him, and it said, "Think of the things that don't fit. Wonder why the nice lady of the knobby classes wanders down into a goblin cave as if it's a natural thing to do." He replied, "Well, Sybil spends half her time at home covered in heavy protective gear and a flame-proof helmet because she likes dragons. It's the sort of thing that knobby ladies tend to do." He considered what he had to say, and responded to himself, "Yes, but dragons are what you might call socially acceptable. Goblins, on the other hand, definitely aren't. No one has got a good word to say for goblins except Miss Beadle. Why not take young Sam along to see her tomorrow? After all, she was the one that got him onto this poo business, and she is a writer, so I expect she'd be quite glad of the interruption. Yes, that'd be a good idea, and it'd be educational for young Sam, and not an investigation at all." Thus satisfied, he waited for the onset of sleep, against a chorus of howls, shrieks, mysterious distant bangs, surreptitious rustlings, screeches, disconcerting ticking noises, dreadful scratching sounds, terrible flappings of wings very close, and all the rest of the unholy orchestra that is known as the peace of the countryside. He had enjoyed a late-night game of snooker with Willikins, just to keep his hand in, and Vimes, half listening now to the outlandish cacophony, wondered whether the solving of a complex crime, one that needed a certain amount of care, could be compared to a game of snooker. Sure, there were a lot of red balls, and they got in the way, so you had to knock them down, but your target, your ultimate target, was going to be the black. Powerful people lived in the Shires, and so he would tread with care. Metaphorically, Sam Vimes, somewhere in his head, picked up his cue. He lay back in the bed, enjoying the wonderful sensation of gradually being eaten by the pillows, and said to Sybil, "Do the Rust family ever place down here?" Too late, he reflected, that this might be a bad move, because she might well have told him all about it on one of those occasions when, so unusually for a married man, he was not paying much attention to what his wife was saying, and therefore he might be the cause of grumpiness in those precious warm minutes before sleep. All he could see of her right now was the very tip of her nose, as the pillows claimed her, but she mumbled drowsily, "'No, they bought Hangnail Manor 10 years or so ago, "'after the Marquis of Fantailer murdered his wife with a pruning knife in the Pineapple House. "'Don't you remember? "'You spent weeks searching the city for him. "'In the end, everybody seemed to think he'd gone off to 4X "'and disguised himself by not calling himself the Marquis of Fantailer.' "'Oh, yes,' said Vimes. "'And I remember that a lot of his chums were quite indignant about the investigation.' They said that he'd only done one murder, and it was his wife's fault for having the bad taste to die after just one little stab. Lady Sybil turned over, which meant that, since she was a woman happily rich in gravitational attraction, as she turned, the pillow closest to Sam, acting like a gear in a chain, spun softly in the opposite direction, so that Sam Vimes found himself now lying on his face. He struck out for the surface again and said, "'And Rust bought it, did he?' It's unusual for the old fart to spend a penny more than he needs to. It wasn't him, dear. It was Gravid. Vimes woke a little more. The son. The criminal. I believe, Sam, that the word is entrepreneur, and I'd like to go to sleep now if it's all the same to you. Sam Vimes knew that the best thing he could say was nothing, and he sank back into the depths, thinking words like fiddler, sharp dealer, inserter of a crafty crowbar between what is right and wrong, and mine and thine, wide boy, financier, and untouchable. Gently drifting into a nightmare world where the good guys and bad guys so often changed hats without warning, Vimes wrestled sleeplessness to the ground and made certain that it got 8 hours. Next morning, Vimes, hand in hand with his son, walked thoughtfully towards the house of Miss Beadle, not knowing what to expect. He had little experience of the literary world, much preferring the literal one, and he had heard that writers spent all day in their dressing gowns drinking champagne. This is, of course, absolutely true. On the other hand, as he approached the place up another little lane, some reconsideration began to take place. For one thing, the cottage had a garden that would do credit to a farm. When he looked over the fence, he saw rows of vegetables and soft fruit, and there was an orchard and what was probably a pigsty and, over there, a proper outdoor privy, very professionally done, with the very nearly compulsory crescent moon-shape fret-sword into the door, and the log pile close at hand so that the most efficient use could be made of every trip down the path. The whole place had a sensible and serious air, and certainly wasn't what you would expect of somebody who just mucked about with words every day. Miss Beadle opened the door a fraction of a second after he had knocked. She didn't look surprised. "'I was rather expecting you, Your Grace,' she said. "'What is it, Mr. Policeman, today? "'From what I hear, it's always Mr. Policeman one way or the other.' "'Then she looked down. "'And this must be young Sam.' "'She glanced up at his father and said, "'They tend to get rather tongue-tied, don't they?' "'You know, I've got lots of poo,' said young Sam proudly. "'I keep it in jam jars, and I've got a laboratory in the lavatory. "'Have you got any elephant poo? It goes!' "'And here he paused for effect. "'Dung!' For a moment, Miss Beadle had that slightly glazed sheen often seen on the face of someone meeting young Sam for the first time. She looked at Vimes. "'You must be very proud of him.' The proud father said, "'It's very hard to keep up, I know that.' Miss Beadle led the way out of the hall and into a room in which chintz played a major part, and drew young Sam over to a large bureau. She opened a drawer and handed the boy what looked like a small book. "'This is a bound proof of the joy of earwax, and I shall sign it for you if you'd like.' Young Sam took it like one receiving a holy object, and his father, temporarily becoming his mum, said, "'What do you say?' To which young Sam responded with a beam and a thank you and a, "'Please don't scribble on it. I'm not allowed to scribble in books.' While young Sam was happily turning the pages of his new book, his father was introduced to an overstuffed chair. Miss Beadle gave him a smile and hurried off towards the kitchen, leaving Vimes with not much to look at except for a room full of bookcases, more overstuffed furniture, a full-size concert harp, and a wall clock made to look like an owl, whose eyes swung backwards and forwards hypnotically in time with the tick, presumably to the point where they either committed suicide or picked up the poker in the hearth nearby and beat the damn thing until the springs broke. While Vimes was warmly contemplating this, he realised that he was being watched, and he looked round into the worried face and prognathous jaw of the goblin called Tears of the Mushroom. Instinctively, he looked at young Sam, and suddenly the biggest raisin in his cake of apprehension was, what will young Sam do? How many books has he read? They haven't told him nasty tales about goblins, have they? Or read him too many of those innocent, colourful fairy tale books which contains nightmares ready to leap out and some needless fear that would cause trouble one day? And what young Sam did was march across the floor, stop dead in front of the girl and say, "I know a lot about poo. It's very interesting." Tears of the Mushroom looked frantically for Miss Beadle, while young Sam, totally at ease, began a brief dissertation on sheep poo. In response, with words slapping together like little bricks, she said, "What is poo for?" Young Sam frowned at this as if somebody was questioning his life's work. Then he looked up brightly and said, "Without poo, you would go off bang." And he stood there beaming, the meaning of life completely solved. And Tears of the Mushroom laughed. It was a rather staccato laugh, reminding Vimes of the laughter of certain kinds of women after certain kinds of too much gin. But it was laughter, straight, genuine, and unaffected, and young Sam bathed in it, giggling, and so did Sam Vimes, with sweat beginning to cool on his neck. Then young Sam said, "I wish I had big hands like you. What's your name?" In that clipped way Vimes was learning to recognise, the goblin girl said, "I am Tears of the Mushroom." Instantly, young Sam threw his arms around as much of her as he could encompass and shouted, "Mushroom shouldn't cry!" The look that the goblin girl gave Vimes was one that he had seen many times before on the face of someone in receipt of young Sam's hugs, a mixture of surprise and what Vimes had to call nonplussedness. At this point, Miss Beadle came back into the room holding a plate which she passed to Tears of the Mushroom. "Please be so good as to serve our guests, my dear." Tears of the Mushroom picked up the plate and tentatively pushed it towards Vimes, and said something that sounded like half a dozen coconuts rolling downstairs, but somehow managed to include the syllables "you" and "eat" and "I make." There seemed to be a pleading in her expression, as if trying to make him understand. Vimes stared at her face a while and then thought, "Well, I could understand, couldn't I? It has to be worth a try." And closed his eyes, an errand of some dubiousness when you were face to longer face with a jaw like that. With eyes firmly shut, and one hand over them to cut out that last vestige of light, he said, "Will you say that again, young lady?" And in the darkness of his skull, he heard quite clearly, "I have baked biscuits today, Mr. Policeman. I washed my hands," she added nervously. "They are clean and tasty. This I have said, and it is a thing exact." "Bait by a goblin," thought Vimes as he opened his eyes and took a knobbly but appetizing-looking biscuit from the plate in front of him, then shut his eyes again and asked, "Why does the mushroom cry?" In the dark he heard the goblin girl gasp and then say, "It cries so that there are many more mushrooms. This is a certain thing." Vimes heard the faint chink of crockery behind him, but as he took his hands away from his eyes, Miss Beadle said, "No, stay in the darkness, Commander. So it's true what the dwarfs say about you." "I wouldn't know. What do the dwarfs say about me, Miss Beadle?" Vimes opened his eyes. Miss Beadle sat down on a chair almost opposite, while Tears of the Mushroom waited for more biscuit activity with the air of someone who would probably wait forever or until told not to. She looked imploringly at Vimes and then at young Sam, who was studying Tears of the Mushroom with interest, although, knowing young Sam, most of the interest had to do with the plate of biscuits. So he said, "Okay, lad, you may ask the lady for a biscuit, but mind your manners." "They say that the dark is in you, Commander, but you keep it in a cage. A present from Coon Valley, they say." Vimes blinked in the light. "A dwarf superstition in a goblin cave. You know a lot about dwarfs." "Quite a lot," said Miss Beadle, "but far more about goblins, and they believe in the summoning dark just like the dwarfs. After all, they are both creatures of the caves, and the summoning dark is real. It's not all in your head, Commander. No matter what you hear, I sometimes hear it too." "Oh, dear, you of all people must recognise a substition when you're possessed by it. It's the opposite of a superstition. It's real, even if you don't believe in it. My mother taught me that. She was a goblin." Vimes looked at the pleasant brown-haired woman in front of him and said politely, "No." "All right, then, perhaps you'll allow me a little theatricality and misdirection for effect. Truthfully, my mother was found as a child when she was 3 and raised by goblins in Umavout, until she was about 11, and I say about because she was never quite certain about the passage of time. She pretty much thought and acted like a goblin, and picked up their language, which is insanely difficult to learn if you're not brought up to it. She ate with them, had her own plot in the mushroom farm, and was very highly thought of among them for the way that she looked after the rat farm. She once told me that until she met my father, all her best recollections were of those years in the Goblin Cave. Miss Beadle stirred her coffee and continued, "And she also told me her worst recollections, the ones that haunted her nightmares, and, I might say, haunt mine now. Of one day, after some nearby humans had found out there was a golden-haired, pink-cheeked human girl running around underground with evil, treacherous brutes, who, as everybody knows, eat babies. Well, she screamed and fought as they tried to take her away, especially since people who she had thought of as family were being slaughtered around her." There was a pause, and Vimes glanced somewhat fearfully at young Sam, who thankfully had returned to the joy of earwax and was therefore oblivious of all else. "You haven't touched your coffee, Commander. You're just holding it in your hand and looking at me." Vimes took a deep draught of very hot coffee, which at the moment suited him just fine. He said, "This is true. I'm sorry, I don't know what to say." Tears of the Mushroom was watching him carefully, ready should he feel a biscuit attack coming on. They were, in fact, pretty good, and to hide his confusion he thanked her and took another one. "Best not to say anything at all, then," said Miss Beadle. "All slaughtered for no reason at all. It happens. Everybody knows that are worthless people, don't they? I tell you, Commander, it's true that some of the most terrible things in the world are done by people who think, genuinely think, that they're doing it for the best, especially if there is some god involved. Well, it took a lot of those things, and quite a lot of time, to convince a little girl that she wasn't one of the nasty goblins anymore, and was really one of the human beings who were not nasty at all, because they were certain she would understand that all this terrible business with the bucket of cold water and the beatings every time she spoke in goblin tongue, or started absent-mindedly to sing a goblin song, was in her best interest. Fortunately, although she probably didn't think so at the time, she was strong and clever, and she learned. Learned to be a good girl, learned to wear proper dresses and eat with a knife and fork, and kneel down to pray her thanks for all that she was receiving, including the beatings. And she learned not to be a goblin so successfully that they allowed her to work in the garden, where she vaulted over the wall. They never broke her, and she said to me that there would always be some goblin in her. I never met my father. According to my mother, he was a decent and hard-working man, and a considerate and understanding one too, I suspect. Miss Beadle stood up and brushed at her dress, as if trying to remove the crumbs of history. Standing there, in the chintzy room with the harp in it, she said, "I don't know who those people were who killed the goblins and beat my mother, but if I ever found out, I would slaughter them without a thought. Because good people have no business being so bad. Goodness is about what you do, not what you pray to." "And that's how it went," she said. "My father was a jeweller, and he soon found out that my mother was absolutely gifted in that respect, probably because of her goblin background that led her to have a feel for stones. I'm sure that made up for having a wife who would swear in goblin when she was annoyed. And let me tell you, a good goblin swear can go on for at least a quarter of an hour. She wasn't one for the books, as you might expect, but my dad had been, and one day I thought, how hard can writing be? After all, most of the words are going to be and, the, and I, and it, and so on, and there's a huge number to choose from, so a lot of the work has already been done for you. That was 57 books ago. It seems to have worked." Miss Beadle sat back down in her chair and leaned forward. "They have the most complex language you could possibly imagine, Commander. The meaning of every word is contingent on the words around it, the speaker, the listener, the time of year, the weather, oh, and so many other things. They have something equivalent to what we think of as poetry. They use and control fire, and about 3 years ago nearly all of them in this countryside were rounded up and carted away because they were a nuisance. Isn't that why you're here?" Vimes took a deep breath. "Actually, Miss Beadle, I came here to see my wife's family estate and let my lad learn about the countryside. In the process of which I've already been arrested on suspicion of killing a blacksmith and have seen the brutally slaughtered body of a goblin woman. On top of this, I have no knowledge of the whereabouts of said blacksmith, and, Miss Beadle, would like somebody to enlighten me, preferably yourself. Yes, I saw the poor thing, and I'm sorry that I can't tell you where Jethro is." Vimes stared at her and thought, "She's probably telling the truth. He's not hiding in some part of the mine, is he?" "No, I've looked. I've looked everywhere. No note, nothing. and his parents have no idea either. He's a bit of a free spirit, but he's not the sort of person to go away without telling me." She looked down, clearly embarrassed. The silence said a lot. Vimes broke it by saying, "The murder of that poor girl on the hill will not go unpunished while I live. I'm taking it personally, you might say. I think someone was trying to set me up, and mud sticks." He paused. "Tell me, these pots the goblins make, do they carry them around all the time?" "Well, yes, of course, but only the ones they're filling at the moment, obviously," said Miss Beadle with a trace of annoyance. "Is this relevant?" "Well, a policeman, you might say, thinks in goblin language. Everything is contingent on everything else. Incidentally, how many other people know that you have a tunnel into the hill?" "What makes you think I have a tunnel going into the hill?" "Let me see now. This place is practically at the foot of the hill, and if I lived here, I'd have dug out a decent wine cellar for myself. That's one reason. And the other is because I saw the flash in your eyes when I asked you the question. Would you like me to ask you the question again?" The woman opened her mouth to speak, and Vimes raised a finger. "Not finished yet. What isn't so simple as that is the fact that yesterday you arrived in the cave without anybody seeing you walk up the hill. Everyone tells me that there are eyes watching you everywhere in the country, and as luck would have it, I had a few working for me yesterday. Please don't waste my time. You committed no crime that I know of. You understand being kind to goblins is not a crime." He thought about that and added, "Although perhaps some people round here might think it is. But I don't, and I'm not stupid, Miss Beadle. I saw that goblin head in the pub. It looked as if it had been there for years. Now, I just want to go back up to the cave without anybody seeing me, if you don't mind, because I have a few questions to ask." Miss Beadle said, "You want to interrogate the goblins?" "No. That word suggests that I mean to bully them. I simply have to obtain the information I need to know before I start to investigate the murder of the girl. If you don't want to help me, I'm afraid that will be your choice." The next day, Sergeant Colon did not turn up for work. Mrs. Colon sent a note around by a boy as soon as she got back from work herself. The Colons had survived a long and happy marriage by having as little to do with each other as possible. This was achieved by the expedient of him working the night shift when she was working days, and vice versa. They had agreed on this on the basis that anything else would have spoiled the romance. There was nothing romantic about Fred Colon when she got home, and so, after sweeping the floor, doing the washing up, wiping all the surfaces and spending some time teasing out the lumps of mud that had got caught in the doormat, she made haste to Pseudopolis Yard, after visiting her friend Mildred, who had a rather nice porcelain jug and basin set she wanted to sell. When she eventually got to the watch house, she explained that Fred was terribly poorly and sweating cobs and gabbling about rabbits. Sergeant Littlebottom was sent to investigate, and returned looking solemn as she climbed the steps to Vimes's office, now occupied by Captain Carrot. You could tell he was the occupant now, not simply because he was sitting in the chair, which was a persuasive hint, but also because all the paperwork was done and aligned, a trait which always impressed Inspector A.E. Pesimal, a small man who had the heart of a lion and the physical strength of a kitten, and the face, disposition, and general demeanour that would make even hardened accountants say, "Just look at him, doesn't he look like a typical accountant to you?" But this didn't worry the lion heart of A.E. Pesimal. He was the watch's secret weapon. There wasn't a bookkeeper in the city who would like to see a visit from A.E. Pesimal, unless, of course, he was perfectly innocent, although generally that could be ruled out, because Mr. and Mrs. Pesimal's little boy could track an error all the way through the ledger and down into the cellar where the real books had been hidden. And all Inspector A.E. Pesimal wanted for his genius was a meticulously calculated wage and a chance, every now and again, to go out on the streets with a real policeman, swinging his truncheon and glaring at trolls. Carrot leaned back. "So, how's Fred getting on, Cheery?"
"Nothing much that I can see, really. That was a big Cheery."
The trouble was that Captain Carrot had a friendly, honest and open face that made you want to tell him things. It didn't help that Sergeant Littlebottom held a small torch for the captain, even though he was well and truly spoken for. He was also a dwarf, well, technically, and you can't help how you dream. "Well," she began, reluctantly. Carrot leaned forward. "Yes, Cheery?" She gave in.
"Well, sir, it's Ungu. You come from Copperhead. Did you run into many goblins up there?"
"No, but I know that Ungu is their religion, if you can call it that."
Cheery Little Bottom shook her head, trying to get out of her mind some speculation about the part a reasonably high stool might play in a relationship, and telling herself that Sergeant Hammer of Gold, over in the Dolly Sisters' watch house, caught her eye every time she was busily catching his eye when they happened to meet on patrol, and was probably a really good catch if she could pluck up the courage to ask him if he was actually male. Strictly speaking, the sexuality of any given dwarf remains a secret between him, or, as it might be, her, and his, or, as it might be, her mother, until they decided to tell someone else about it, although generally you could work it out by observing dwarfs closely and spotting the ones that were drinking sherry or light white wine. Regrettably, this didn't always work with dwarf policemen, because, like all policemen everywhere, they would drink anything strong enough to help them forget what they'd had to deal with that day. She said, "Ongu is not a religion, it's a superstition. The goblins don't believe in tack, sir." According to dwarf lore, the universe was written into being by Tak, who also wrote its laws. All writing is sacred to the dwarfs. "They're savages, scavengers, but..." She hesitated again. "There's something I was told once, and it's unbelievable, but sometimes they eat their babies, sir. Or at least, the mother will eat her child, her newborn child, if there's famine. Can you believe that?" Carrot's mouth dropped open for a moment, and then a small voice said, "Yes, I think I can, Sergeant, if you would excuse my saying so." A.E. Pessimal looked defiantly at their expressions and tried to stand a little straighter. "It's a matter of logic, you see. No food, but the mother may survive by reconsuming the child, as it were, whereas if all other food has been exhausted, then the child will die. In fact, the child is dead as soon as the conundrum is postulated. The mother, on the other hand, might, by so doing, survive for long enough for more food to be found and to become available, and in the course of time may bear another child."
"You know, that is a very accountancy thing to say," said Cheery.
A.E. Pessimal remained calm.
"Thank you, Sergeant Littlebottom. I shall take that as a compliment, because the logic is impeccable. It's what is known as the dreadful logic of necessity. I'm well versed in the logistics of survival situations."
The chair creaked as Captain Carrot leaned forward.
"No offence meant, Inspector Pessimal, but may I inquire as to what kind of issues of survival arise during double-entry bookkeeping?"
A.E. Pessimal sighed.
"It can get pretty hazardous as the end of the fiscal year draws near, Captain. However, I take your point and would like you to understand that I believe I have read every single memoir, manual, log and message in a bottle, by which I mean, of course, message taken from a bottle, that is currently available, and I can assure you that you would be amazed at the terrible decisions that sometimes have to be made by a group of people so that some, if not all, may live. Classically, we have the shipwrecked sailors adrift in an open boat, far on the ocean with succour extremely unlikely. Generally, the procedure is to eat one another's legs, although sooner or later the supply of legs is going to run, if I may use the word, out. And then arises the question, who will die so that some may live? Dreadful algebra, Captain.
Only then did A.E. Pessimal blush.
"I'm sorry. I know that I am a small, weak man, but I have amassed a large library. I dream of dangerous places."
"Perhaps you should walk through the sheaves, Inspector," said Carrot. "You wouldn't have to dream. Do carry on, Cheery."
Cheery Littlebottom shrugged.
"But eating your own child, that's got to be wrong, yes?"
"Well, Sergeant," said A.E. Pessimal, "I have read about such things, and if you think of the outcomes, which are the death of both mother and child, or the death of the child but the possible life of the mother, the conclusion must be that her decision is right. In his book, A Banquet of Worms, Colonel F. J. Massingham does mention this about the goblins, and apparently, according to the goblins' world view, a consumed child, which clearly did emerge from the mother, has been returned whence it came, and will hopefully be reborn anew at some future date, when circumstances are more favourable, with therefore no actual harm done. You may think that this view does not stand up to scrutiny, but when you're faced with a dreadful algebra, the world becomes quite a different place."
There was silence while they all contemplated this. Carrot said,
"You know how it is in a street fight, Cheery. Sometimes if things get hot and you know it's you or them, that's when you do the algebra."
"Fred doesn't seem to know where he is," said Cheery. "He wasn't running a temperature, and his bedroom isn't particularly warm. But he acts as if he's very hot, and he won't let go of that damned little pot. He shouts if anyone tries even to get near it. Actually, he screamed at me. And that's another thing. His voice has changed. He sounds like a man who's gargling rocks. I had a word with Ponder Stibbons at the university, but they don't appear to have anyone who knows anything much about goblins." Captain Carrot raised his eyebrows. "Are you sure? I know for a fact they have a professor of dust, miscellaneous particles and filaments, and you tell me there's no expert on an entire species of talking humanoids?" "That's about right, sir. All we could turn up was stuff about what a bloody nuisance they are. You know the kind of thing." "Nobody knows anything about goblins. I mean stuff worth knowing." A.E. Pessimal actually saluted. "Harry King does, Captain. There's quite a few of them at Downriver. They don't come into town much, though. You may remember that Lord Veterinari was gracious enough to ask for me to be seconded to the revenue in order that I might go through Mr. King's returns, given that all the other tax officers were frightened to set foot on his property. I myself, sir, was not frightened," said A.E. Pessimal proudly, "because I am protected by my badge and the majesty of the law. Harry King might throw a tax man out of the building, but he's clever enough not to try that with one of Commander Vimes's men now, indeed." You could have lit the city with the proud glow from A.E. Pessimal's face as he tried to puff out a chest that mostly went in. It became a little more swollen when Carrot said, "Very well done, Inspector. You're a mean man with a smoking abacus indeed. I think I shall pay a visit to our old friend Harry first thing in the morning." Vimes did some thinking about the problem of taking young Sam to a crime scene, but frankly the lad was showing himself to be up to just about any encounter. Besides, any lad wants to go and see where his dad works. He looked down at his son. "Would you be scared of a long walk in the dark, lad, with me and these ladies?" Young Sam looked solemn for a moment and then said, "I think I'll let Mr. Whistle do the being scared, and then it won't bother me." The door to the secret tunnel, if indeed it was secret, was in Miss Beadle's cellar, which had quite a well-appointed wine rack and a general, not unpleasant smell of, well, a cellar. But once through the door, there was a smell of distant goblins. It was a long walk in the dark, especially when you were obliged to walk up quite a steep slope very nearly on hands and knees. The smell of goblins grew stronger after a while, but during that while you tended to get used to it. Here and there, light shone into the gloom from holes to the outside world, which Vimes thought was sensible engineering, until he realised that rabbits used this tunnel too, and had left plenty of droppings as evidence. He wondered whether he should pocket a few samples for young Sam's collection, and suggested this to young Sam, toiling manfully behind him, who said, "No, Dad, got rabbits, want elephant if we find one." Rabbit poo, Vimes noticed, was about the size of a chocolate raisin, a thought which instantly dragged him back to his youth, when if by some means never entirely legal he had acquired some cash, he would spend it on a ticket to the Flea Pit musical and buy a packet of chocolate raisins with the change. Nobody knew, or cared to guess, what the things were that scuttled and scratched down below the seats, but you soon learned a very important rule. If you dropped your chocolate raisins, it was vitally important not to pick them up. Vimes stopped, causing Miss Beadle to walk into the sack of apples that she had asked him to carry, and got a grip on himself sufficiently to say, "I'd like a moment or two to catch my breath, Miss Beadle. Sorry, not as young as I was and all that. I'll catch you up. What are we carrying these bags for, anyway?" "Fruit and vegetables, Commander." "What? To goblins? I'd have thought they found their own food." Miss Beadle inched her way around him and climbed on into the dark, saying over her shoulder, "Yes, they do." Vimes sat with young Sam for a moment until he felt better, and said, "How are you doing, lad?" In the dark a small voice said, "I told Mr. Whistle not to worry, Dad, because he's a bit silly." "So is your father," thought Vimes, "and is probably going to continue to be so. But he was on the chase. One way or another, he was on the chase. Who you were chasing could wait. The chasing was the thing." Anger helped Vimes up the last leg of the climb, anger at himself and whoever it was who had punctured his holiday. But it was worrying. He had wanted something to happen, and now it had. Somebody was dead. Sometimes you had to take a look at yourself and then look away. He found Miss Beadle and Tears of the Mushroom waiting with a dozen or so other ladies. It was a calculated guess, given that he had yet to find any reliable way of telling one goblin from another, except, of course, that Tears of the Mushroom was wearing her apron with pockets in, which he hadn't seen before, and apparently neither had the other ladies, since Tears of the Mushroom was now the hit of the season as far as her sisters were concerned, given that they currently wore daring little outfits of old sacking, plaited grasses and rabbit skin. They gathered around her, chorusing, presumably, the goblin equivalent of, "Oh, my dear, you look fabulous." However that might be rendered in a language that at its best sounded like a man jumping up and down on a very large packet of crisps. Miss Beadle sidled up to Vimes and said, "I know what you're thinking, but it's a start. Carrying things, useful things, without having to use your hands, well, that's a step in the right direction." She pulled Vimes a little way from the newly formed goblin branch of the Women's Institute, who had by now attracted the attention of young Sam, whose cheerful reluctance to be overawed by anything had clearly won over the girls, resulting with his being where he always felt he should be, the centre of attention. It was a knack. Miss Beadle went on, "If you want to change a whole people, and you start with the girls, it stands to reason. They learn faster, and they pass on what they learn to their children. I suppose you're wondering why we are trekking up here with all these sacks." Behind them, the apron was being tried on by one girl after another, this year's must-have item. Vimes turned back to the woman and said, "Well, this is just a guess, but I see a lot of rabbit bones around the place, and I have heard that you can die if you live only on rabbit, only I don't know why this is." Miss Beadle lit up. "Well, Commander Vimes, you've certainly gone up in my estimation. Yes, rabbits have been the scourge of the goblin nation. I understand it depletes the body of some vital nutrient if you don't eat other things as well. Just about any green stuff will do, but the male goblins think a proper meal was a rabbit on a stick." She sighed. "Dwarfs know about this, and they're absolutely fanatical about good food, as you should be if you spend much of your time underground, but nobody cared to tell the goblins, as if they would listen anyway, and so bad health and premature death is their lot. Some survive, of course, mostly those who prefer rat or eat the whole rabbit, not just the more apparently edible bits, or they simply eat their vegetables." She began to unfasten a sack of cabbages and continued, "I was well in with the wife of the head man here, because he got sick and I made certain he got a few good meals. Of course, he swears it was because he did the magic, but his wife was remarkably sensible, and the other males don't worry about what the girls get up to, so they slip fruit and veg into their stews, saying they're magical. And so they have children who survive, and thus we change the world one meal at a time. That is, if the goblins get a chance to live at all." She looked sadly at the gossiping girls and said, "What they really need is a first-class theologian, because, you see, they agree with the rest of the world. They think they're rubbish. They think they did something very bad a long time ago, and because of it, they've lived like they do. They think they have it coming to them, as you might say." Vimes frowned. He couldn't remember ever going into a church or temple or one of the numerous other places of more or less spirituality for any other reason than the occasional requirements of the job. These days he tended to go in for reasons of Sybil, i.e. his wife dragging him along so that he could be seen, and, if possible, be seen remaining awake. No, the world of next worlds, afterlives, and purgatorial destinations simply did not fit into his head. Whether you wanted it or not, you were born, you did the best you could, and then, whether you really wanted to or not, you died. They were the only certainties, and so the best thing for a copper to do was to get on with the job. And it was about time that Sam Vimes got back to doing his. Young Sam, at this point, had tired of petticoat company and had drifted over to an elderly goblin man who was working on a pot, and was watching with extreme fascination to the apparent pleasure, as far as Vimes could tell, of the elderly goblin. "That's a lesson to us. I don't know what kind of lesson, but it's a lesson," he thought. Vimes waited until his Beadle returned from discussing the possible new fashion explosion with the girls, and then politely asked her, "Did the victim have any ungue pots on her?" "I would be amazed if she hadn't," said Miss Beadle. "One or two at the very least, but probably the quite small ones for use during the day." "I see," said Vimes. "But were any found on her... afterwards, I mean, if she was laid out?" He didn't know what the protocol was and continued, "Look, Miss Beadle, is it possible that she had an ungue pot on her that's now missing? I know they're valuable, of course, they're shiny." "I don't know, but I'll go and ask the Cold Bone Wakes. He's the head goblin, he'll know." That reminded Vimes. Feeling embarrassed, he delved into his pocket and took out a small package, very, very carefully wrapped, and handed it to Miss Beadle with a pleading look.
I believe this belonged to the dead girl," he said. "A stone ring with a little blue bead in it. Can you see that it gets to someone here who'll value it?" All she had was a stone ring, he thought, and even that got taken away. There were times when the world did not need policemen, because what it really did need was for somebody who knew what they were doing to shut it all down and start it all up again, so that this time it could be done properly. But before despair could entirely set in, Miss Beadle was back, and excited. "How apposite that you should ask that question, Commander. One of them was missing. Ungu Cat." Vimes could register absolute flat-faced incomprehension as well as any copper born. It radiated a searchlight of ignorance, but that was fine because Miss Beadle was prepared to be a fountainhead of information. "I'm sure you know what everybody knows, Commander, which is that goblins do, I might say religiously, store certain bodily secretions in pots, in the belief that these must be reunited with their corpse when they are buried. This obligation is called ungu. All goblins must, by custom, which is very strict among goblins, maintain the ungu had, the trinity of snot, nail, clippings, and earwax. The missing pot in this case is the pot of cat, which contains nail clippings. Don't get misled by the word cat. Felines don't come into the picture. It's simply that there are only so many syllables in the world." "And this is the first time you've heard that it's missing, Miss Beadle?" "Well, this is my first time down here since yesterday, and it's a difficult time to talk to her family, as you may imagine." "I see," said Vimes, though he didn't, not very much, although he could sense a tiny bead of light growing in the darkness of his mind. He glanced again at young Sam, who was studying the potmaker with every sign of forensic interest. "That's my boy," he continued. "Did they look for the pot?" "Looked everywhere, Commander, even outside. And it'll be quite small. You see, every goblin makes a set of pots which are kept deep inside the cave. I don't know where they are, though in most other things they trust me. This is because humans steal pots. For this reason, most goblins make other comparatively small pots for daily use and for when they leave the cave, and decant them into the larger pots later in secret." She tried to smile and said, "I'm sure this seems quite outlandish to you, Commander, but the making and maintaining of the pots is to them a religion in itself." At this point, Samuel Vimes was not keen to be heard giving his views about pots, so he contented himself with saying, "Is it possible that another goblin might have stolen the pot? Anyway, what size is quite small?" Miss Beadle gave him a surprised look. "If you trust me on anything, Commander, trust me on this. No goblin would dream of stealing another goblin's pot. The concept of doing so would be totally alien to them, I assure you. The size? Oh, usually similar to a lady's compact or perhaps a snuff box. They have a shine on them like opals." "Yes," said Vimes, "I know." And he thought, "Bright colours in the dark." He said, "I don't want to be difficult, but could I borrow another of the poor lady's pots? I might need one to show people what it is I'm looking for." Miss Beadle looked surprised again. "That would be impossible. But I think if I talk to Tears the Mushroom, she might, just might, loan you one of hers, in which case I may say you will be a very special person, Commander. A pot usually changes hands only because of distress. But Tears the Mushroom spends a lot of time with me and has learned, shall I say, the uses of flexible thinking. And if I may say so, she has taken a little bit of a shine to you." She walked away, leaving the startled Vimes and young Sam to their own devices. Here and there, goblins were doing whatever they did, tending small fires, sleeping, or, in many cases, fussing with their pots. And a few just sat there staring blankly at nothing at all, like a policeman wondering how you spelled phantasmagorical. And a new image dragged itself out of Vimes's memory. It was of a lot of little blue men shouting Crivens. Ah, yes, the Knack Mac Feagle. They lived in holes in the ground as well. Admittedly, these were said to be rather more salubrious than this midden-ridden cave system, but however you looked at it, they were in the same situation as the goblins. They lived on the edge too, but they danced on the edge. They jumped up and down on it, made faces at it, thumbed their snotty noses at it, refused to see the peril of their situation, and, in general, seemed to have a huge appetite for life, adventure, and alcohol. As a copper, he shouldn't say it, because they could be a bloody nuisance, but there was something commendable about the cheerfully feisty way they faced, well, everything. Somebody tugged at his sleeve. He looked down into the face of Tears of the Mushroom,
with Miss Beadle standing over her like a chaperone. The other goblin girls stood behind the pair of them like an Ephesian chorus. The solemn voice from the little face said,
"Hearts must give, Mr. Policeman."
With dreadfully bad timing, Miss Beadle broke in like an overactive schoolteacher, and Vimes was privately overjoyed to see a brief look of annoyance on Tears the Mushroom's face. "She means that if she is to trust you with a pot, then you must trust her with something equally valuable. I suppose you would call it a hostage situation." "No, I wouldn't," Vimes thought, looking into the dark eyes of the goblin girl. That was a strange thing. When he got past the features, which at best could be considered homely, depending on what kind of home you had in mind, the eyes were as human as you could imagine. They had a depth that not even the brightest animal could achieve. He reached for his wallet, and Miss Beadle said sharply, "Money won't do." He ignored her and finished pulling out the picture of young Sam that he took everywhere, and carefully passed it to Tears the Mushroom, who accepted it as if holding a rare and delicate object, which, from the point of view of Vimes, it certainly was. She looked at it, then down at the boy himself, who gave her a cheery smile, and her eyes confirmed that the grimace on her face was in fact an answering smile. For young Sam, the Goblin Cave was an interesting fairyland. You had to admire his ability not to be immediately frightened of anything. Tears of the Mushroom looked back at the picture, and then back at young Sam, and then at the face of Vimes. She tucked the picture carefully into her apron, and pulled out a small iridescent pot. She held it out to Vimes, her hand trembling slightly, and he found himself taking it gingerly in both hands. Then Tears of the Mushroom said in her strange voice, like a living filing cabinet, "Hearts have given," which almost brought Vimes to his knees. He thought, it could just as well have been her head grinning on the pub wall. Someone is going to burn. In the back of his mind, a cheerful voice said, "Well done, Commander Vimes. At last you are singing from my hymn sheet." He ignored it, feeling the little pot. It was as smooth as skin. Whatever it was made to contain, and he wasn't going to ask, the contents were masked by a carved latticework of flowers and mushrooms. In the cool depths of his cellar, Jiminy the publican was preparing for the evening rush when he heard a sound in the darkness among the barrels. He dismissed it as being yet another rat until a hand was clamped over his mouth. "Excuse me, sir. I have reason to believe that you can help me with my inquiries." The man struggled, but Vimes knew every trick when it came to apprehending a suspect. He hissed, "You know who I am, sir, and I know what you are. We're both coppers, and we've been around the houses. You said that the barman sees everything, hears everything, and says nothing. And I'm a fair man, Mr. Jiminy, but I'm investigating a murder." "A murder, sir, the capital crime. And maybe something much, much worse. So excuse me if I take the view that those who aren't behind me are standing in my way with all that that entails." Jiminy was running out of breath now and squirming feebly. "Oh, too much of the booze and too little walking the beat, I fancy," said Vimes. "Now, I would not ask a man to break the barman's solemn oath, so when I take my hand away, we'll sit down peacefully and play a little game of charades. I'm letting go now." The barman wheezed a curse and added, "You didn't need to do that, Commander. I got a bad chest, you know." "Not as bad as it might otherwise be, Mr. Jiminy. And now, a word on the subject of being too clever." The publican glared as Vimes went on. "I'm strictly a copper. I don't kill people unless they're trying to kill me. You may be aware of my batman, Mr. Willikins. You saw him the other day. Regrettably, he's more direct and also extremely loyal. A few years ago, to save my family, he killed an armed dwarf with a common ice knife. And he has other talents. Among them, I have to say, is that he can iron a shirt as crisply as any man I know. And, as I say, very loyal indeed. Come on, Jiminy. I'm a copper, and you're a copper. You're still a copper, whatever you say. The stain never leaves you. You know what I can do, and I know what you can do, and you're smart enough to choose the right side." "All right, you don't need to rub it in," Jiminy grumbled. "We both know about the ins and outs." His voice was suddenly and almost theatrically helpful as he crooned, "How may I help you, officer, just like the good citizen that I am?" Vimes carefully pulled out of his coat the little pot. It was indeed about the size of a snuff box. The incongruity was not lost on Vimes. In one pocket he held the glorious gem, quite likely the repository of goblin snot, and in the other he had his own small snuff box. How hilarious would it be if he'd mixed them up?
Jiminy certainly reacted when he saw it, although he probably thought he hadn't. There is a subtle difference between hiding your reaction and showing that you are hiding your reaction.
All right, Mr. Vimes, you're right. We don't have to play games, old coppers like us. I give in. I know what that is. Seen one like it recently, as a matter of fact.
And?
I can give you a name, Mr. Vimes. 'Cause why? 'Cause he's a nutjob, a toe rag, and he ain't from round here. Name is Stratford, or so they call him. A knife cove. The kind of bloke you never want to see walk through your pub door, I don't mind telling you. He isn't off near, thank goodness. The day before yesterday was the first time I've seen him in months. I don't know where he kips, but the snotty bugger he was hanging out with is called Ted Flutter. Works for young Lord Rust up at Angnail. His lordship is big in tobacco, so they tell me. Jiminy stopped.
Vimes interpreted this in exactly the way Jiminy wanted. He was sure Lord Rust was up to something, and by insinuating as much, Jiminy was throwing a bone to Vimes to get the man off his back. Some people would have thought this despicable, but the man was an ex-policeman after all. Jiminy gave a little cough as he endeavoured to find another victim for Vimes to pursue. But Flutter, well, you know, he's just a bloke. If someone needs help for something or other, he's the kind of bloke who'd be the lookout, or be told to take away the bones. When not to mischief, I think he hangs wallpaper and runs a turkey farm up on the road towards Overhang. You can't miss it. It's a stinky old place, and he doesn't take care of his birds. Not entirely all there, in my opinion.
Vimes seized his opening. Tobacco, eh? Oh, yes, Mr. Jiminy, I did think I smelled rather more tobacco down here than might otherwise be expected. And, of course, as a policeman, it's something that I'll have to look into, perhaps, when time allows.
He winked, and Jiminy nodded knowingly.
With the atmosphere now tentatively upbeat, Jiminy said, "They brings a few barrels up here some nights and then picks it up again as and when.
All right, I know it's the revenue and all that, but I don't see the harm. And since we understand one another so well, Mr. Vimes, I've been here for only 3 years. I know there was some stuff way back. Maybe they did scrag a few goblins, I don't know, not my business. Don't know why, don't know who, if you get my meaning."
Jiminy was sweating cobs, Vimes noticed.
There are times when reacting the way that simple common decency requires fails to serve a higher purpose, and because of this Vimes merely gave the man a little smile and said, "One day, Mr. Jiminy, I'll bring a lady here. I think she'd be very interested to see your establishment."
Jiminy was puzzled, but had the grace to say, "I'll look forward to it, Commander."
"What I'm trying to say," said Vimes, "is that if this pub still has the head of a goblin hanging over the bar the next time I'm here, there'll be a mysterious fire. Do you understand? No doubt you want to keep in with young Lord Rust and his chums, because it always pays to keep in with the powerful. I know that well enough. You'll find me a good friend, Mr. Jiminy, and I'd like to suggest to you that it would not be in your interest to have Commander Vimes as your enemy. Just a word to the wise, you know. One copper to another."
With forced cheerfulness, Jiminy said, in a voice that dripped butter and sugar, "No one ever said that Constable Jiminy didn't know how the wind was blowing, and since you've been so gracious as to visit my humble establishment, I think I can take the view that the wind has begun to blow due, Vimes."
Vimes lifted the cellar hatch to the path and said,
"Oh, so do I, Mr. Jiminy, so do I. And if ever the weathercock decides to blow the other way, I'll bite its bloody head off."
Jiminy smiled uncertainly and said, "Do you have jurisdiction here, Commander?" And was dragged by the shirt to within an inch of Vimes's face, eyeball to eyeball, and Vimes said, "Try me." Feeling rather chirpy after this interlude, Vimes jogged to the lane that led to the hill and found Miss Beadle and Tears the Mushroom at the door of the cottage. By the look of it, they had been picking apples. Several baskets of fruit had been piled up. He thought that Tears the Mushroom smiled when she saw him, although how could you tell, really? Goblin faces were hard to read. The pot was dutifully traded back for the picture, and Vimes couldn't help noticing, because he always made a point of noticing, that both he and the girl tried surreptitiously to examine their precious items without causing offence. He was sure he heard Miss Beadle stifle a sigh of relief. "Did you find the murderer?" she said, leaning forward anxiously. She turned to the girl. "Go inside, dear, while I talk to Commander Vimes, will you?"
"Yes, Miss Beadle, I will go inside, as you request."
There it was again, a language of little boxes, opening and shutting as required. The girl disappeared into the house, and Vimes said,
"I have information that two men were in the pub on the night of the murder, and one of them certainly had a pot. Neither of them, I've been led to believe, was a pillar of society."
Miss Beadle clapped her hands. "Well, that's good, isn't it? You have them bang to rights." It always embarrassed Samuel Vimes when civilians tried to speak to him in what they thought was policeman. If it came to that, he hated thinking of them as civilians. What was a policeman, if not a civilian with a uniform and a badge? But they tended to use the term these days as a way of describing people who were not policemen. It was a dangerous habit. Once policemen stopped being civilians, the only other thing they could be was soldiers. He sighed. "As far as I know, miss, it is not illegal to have a goblin pot. Neither is it, strictly speaking, illegal to be described as not a pillar of society. Do goblins sign their pots in some way?" "Oh, yes, indeed, Commander. Goblin pots are always distinctive. Do these criminals have a modus operandi?" Vimes's heart sank. "No, and I don't think they'd know one if they saw it." He tried to say this firmly because Miss Beadle looked as if she would at any moment turn out with a magnifying glass and a bloodhound. Then, falling across his world like a rainbow of sound, came music, drifting out of the open cottage window. He listened with his mouth open, entirely forgetting the conversation. His Grace, the Duke of Anck, Commander Sir Samuel Vimes, was not a man who made a point of frequenting performances of classical music, or indeed any music that you couldn't whistle on the way home. But apparently being a knob carried with it a requirement to attend the opera, the ballet, and as many musical events as Sybil could drag him to. Fortunately, they generally had a box, and Sybil, very wisely, having dragged him to the performance, did not subsequently drag him into consciousness. But some of it seeped through, and it was enough for him to know that what he was hearing was the real highbrow stuff. You couldn't hum it, and at no point did anyone shout, "Whoops, have a banana." It was the pure quill of music, a sound that came close to making you want to fall on your knees and promise to be a better person. He turned wordlessly to Miss Beadle, who said, "She's very good, isn't she?" "That's a harp, isn't it? A goblin playing a harp?" Miss Beadle seemed embarrassed by the fuss. "Certainly, why shouldn't she? Strangely enough, her large hands are suited to the instrument. I don't think she understands the concept of reading music yet, and I have to help her tune it, but she does play it very well. Heaven knows where she's getting the music from." "Heaven?" said Vimes, adding urgently, "How long will she be playing? Have I got time to bring Sybil over here?" He didn't wait for an answer, but hurried off down the lane, clambered over a gate, caused a flock of sheep to explode in all directions, swore at a kissing gate, jumped over the ha-ha, completely ignored the hee-hee, and totally avoided the ho-ho. He hurtled down the drive, scampered up the steps, and providentially went through the front door at exactly the same time as a footman swung it open. Sybil was taking tea with a group of ladies, which appeared to be obligatory procedure in the afternoons, but Vimes leaned against the wall and panted out, "You must come and listen to this music. Bring young Sam. Bring these ladies if they want to come, but whatever you do, come on. I've never heard anything so good." Sybil looked around. "Well, we were just breaking up, Sam. You know you look very flushed. Is anything the matter?" She looked imploringly at her friends, who were already rising in their seats, and said, "I do hope you'll forgive me, ladies. It's so very difficult being the wife of an important man." There was a slight barb to the last syllable. "I'm sure, Sam, that whatever it is can wait until I've said goodbye to my guests. Yes?" And so Sam Vimes shook hands, smiled, and fretted until the last twitterer had tweeted and the last lady had left. Having seen the final carriage away, Lady Sybil came back in, flopped into a chair in front of Sam, and listened to Vimes's garbled account. "And this is that young goblin girl Miss Beadle has been teaching to talk?" Vimes was almost frantic. "Yes, and she plays wonderful music, wonderful. Sam Vimes, when I take you to a concert, you fall asleep in 10 minutes. Do you know what? You've convinced me. Let's go, shall we?" "Where?" said Vimes in husbandly confusion. Sybil affected surprise. "Why, to hear the young lady play the harp, of course. I thought that was what you wanted. I'll go and get my jacket while you find young Sam, please. He's in the laboratory." For Vimes, bewilderment was now accumulating. The laboratory, Sam. You know my family were famous meddlers, don't you? Willikins is in there with him, and I believe they're dissecting some, shall I say, excrement. Make certain they both washed their hands thoroughly," she added, on the way out of the room, "and tell them I was emphatic. And tell young Sam what emphatic means." The coach stood empty in the lane. They hadn't dared knock on the door, not while that heavenly music was drifting out of the cottage window. Sybil was in tears, but often she looked up and said things like, "That shouldn't be possible on a harp." Even young Sam was transfixed. standing there with his little mouth open while the music rushed in and, for a moment upon the world, lifted all hearts and forgave all sins. Not having its work cut out in the case of young Sam, a part of Vimes managed to reflect, but doing a sterling and heavyweight job on his father. And when the music stopped, young Sam said, "More!" And that went for his parents too. They stood there, not looking at one another, and then the cottage door opened and Miss Beadle stepped out. "I saw you out there, of course. Do come in, but quietly. I've made lemonade." She led them through the hall and turned into the living room. Tears of the Mushroom must have been forewarned by Miss Beadle. She sat on a chair next to the harp with her oversized hands clasped demurely over her apron. Wordlessly, young Sam walked over to her and cuddled her leg. The goblin girl looked panicky, and Vimes said, "Don't worry, he just wants to show that he loves you." And he thought, "I've just told a goblin not to be frightened of my son because he loves her, and the world has turned upside down, and all sins are forgiven, except, possibly, mine." As the coach rattled gently back towards Ramkin Hall, Lady Sybil said quietly to Vimes, "I understand that the young lady goblin who was murdered could play the harp as well as Miss Mushroom." Vimes stirred from his inner thoughts and said, "I didn't know that." "Oh, yes," said Sybil in a curiously chatty voice. "Apparently Miss Beadle wants young goblin girls to have something to be proud of." She cleared her throat and, after a pause, said, "Do you have any suspects, Sam?" "Oh, yes, two. I have the testimony of a reliable witness that they were in the area, and I'm beginning to consider a chain of events that might lead me also to the whereabouts of Mr. Jefferson the Smith. This is the countryside, after all. Everyone sees where you go, and you never know who is behind a hedge. I believe they may have heard him invite me to Dead Man's Copse on what the Times would call that fateful night." Sybil looked down at young Sam, dozing between them, and said, "Do you know where they live?" "Yes, one of them at least. I think the other one just hangs around, as they say." And now the rattle of gravel under the wheel told them that they were going down the long drive. Sybil cleared her throat again, and in a quiet voice said, "I fear you may have felt that I was being rather acerbic to you, Sam, on the subject of letting your professional concerns get in the way of our holiday. I may, at times, have been somewhat blunt." "Not at all, Sybil. I fully understood your concern." It seemed that Lady Sybil really could have done with some cough drops, but she carried on carefully and said, "Sam, I'd be very grateful if you could see your way clear to perhaps taking Willikins with you to wherever it is these scoundrels poison the world with their existence, and bring them to justice, if you would be so good." He could feel her trembling with rage and said, "I was considering doing so as soon as possible, my dear, but I must tell you that things may not go entirely in accordance with the rule book. After all, I'm out of my jurisdiction here." But his wife said, "You're a stickler for the book, Sam, and I admire that, for the jurisdiction of a good man extends to the end of the world. Though who will you take them to? Havelock would hang them, you know that, but he's a long way away. Nonetheless, Sam, I am certain of one thing, and it's this. The worst thing you can do is nothing. Go to it, Sam." "Actually, Sybil, I was considering delivering them to the local justices." "What? They're a terrible bunch, apparently using what they call the law here for their own ends. They'll be an enormous stink." Vimes smiled. "Oh dear, do you really think so?" There was no point going to bed, thought Vimes later that evening, and so he kissed his wife goodnight and went to the snooker room where Willikins was idly practising one of the more socially acceptable skills he had learned during a misspent youth. The man straightened up when Vimes walked in and said, "Good evening, Commander. Would you like a sustaining drink to be going on with?" Vimes also indulged in a rare cigar because, well, what good is a snooker room without smoke twisting among the lights and turning the air a desolate blue, the colour of dead hopes and lost chances? Willikins, who knew the protocol, waited until Vimes had made his shot before coughing gently. "Oh, well done, sir, and I understand her ladyship is somewhat vexed about the goblin situation, sir. I believe this to be the case, sir, because I met her in the corridor earlier, and she used language I haven't heard on the lips of a woman since my old mother passed away, God bless her soul, if they can find it. But well done again, sir." Vimes laid his cue aside. "I want to get them all, Willikins. It's no good slamming up some local thug." "Yes, indeed, Commander. It's all about potting the black." Vimes looked up from his fiery drink. "I can see you must have played a lot in your time, Willikins. Did you ever see Pelvic Williams? Very religious man in his way, lived somewhere in Hen and Chicken's Court with his sister. Played like I've never seen anyone else play before or since. I swear he could make a ball jump the table, roll along the edge and drop back onto the cloth just where he wanted it, to drop neatly into the pocket. Vimes gave a grunt of satisfaction and went on. Of course, everyone used to say that was cheating, but he used to stand there as meek as milk, just repeating, "The ball dropped." Tell you the truth, the reason he never got beaten up was that it was an education watching the man. He once sank a ball by bouncing it off the lamp and a pint mug. But, like he said, the ball dropped. Vimes relaxed and said, "The trouble is, of course, that in real life rules are more stringent."
"Yes, indeed, Commander," said Willikins. "Where I used to play, the only rule was that after you'd hit your opponent over the head with your cue, you had to be able to run very fast. I understand from her ladyship that you might be requiring my assistance tonight."
"Yes, please, we're going to the village of Hangnails. It's about 20 miles upriver."
Willikins nodded. "Yes, indeed, sir, once the seat of the Hangnail family, and most notably of Lord Justice Hangnail, who famously declared that he never took account of any plea of not guilty on the basis that criminals always lie, and was, by happy chance, the worshipful master of the benevolent company of rope makers and braiders. With any luck, we'll not see his like again."
"Excellent, Willikins, and we'll stop en route to pick up our keen young local constable, who'll see fair play. I intend to make sure of that."
"Glad to hear it, sir," said Willikins, "but bear this in mind, what does it matter once the ball has dropped?"
It was Mrs. Upshot who opened the cottage door, gave a little scream, slammed the door, opened the door to apologise for slamming the door, and then shut the door carefully, leaving Vimes on the doorstep. 30 seconds later, Feeney opened the door, with his nightshirt half tucked into his trousers.
"Commander Vimes, is something wrong?" he said,
trying valiantly to tuck all the nightshirt inside. Vimes rubbed his hands together briskly.
"Yes, Chief Constable Upshot, almost everything is, but there is one part that can be made right with your help. Regarding the murder of the Goblin Girl, I have sufficient information to warrant apprehending 2 men for questioning. This is your manner, so professionally speaking, I think it's only right and proper that you assist me with the arrests."
Vimes took a step into the room so that the face of Willikins was visible and went on, "And I think you know Willikins, my manservant, who has volunteered to drive my coach and, of course, provide me with a clean white shirt should I need it."
"Yeah,"
growled Willikins, turning to wink at Vimes. "Chief Constable Upshot, I'd be obliged if you would arm yourself with whatever you think you might need, and, since you don't have a pair of handcuffs worth a damn, oh, I'm so sorry, then at least you can source some rope." The face of Feeney Upshot was a whole palette of conflicting emotions. "I'll be working with the famous Commander Vimes, hooray, but this is big and serious, oh dear. But it'll be like being a real policeman, hooray, but there's already a hot water bottle in my bed, oh dear. On the other hand, if it all goes wrong, well, after all, the Duke of Anc owns most of this place, so he'll have to take most of the blame. Hooray! And maybe if I distinguish myself, I can get a job in the city, so that my mum can live in a place where you don't lie awake at night, listening to the mice fighting the cockroaches. Hooray!"
Regrettably, Constable Upshot was overly hopeful. In Ankh-Morpork, the mice and the cockroaches had decided to forget their differences and gang up on the humans.
It was a treat for Vimes to watch the lad's face in the candlelight, especially as Feeney moved his lips as he thought. And so he said, "I'm sure, Chief Constable Upshot, that assistance in this matter will be very helpful to your future career." This last comment caused Mrs. Upshot, peering over her son's shoulder, to flush with pride and say, "Hark at his grace, Feeney! You could make something of yourself, just like I'm always telling you. No arguing now, off you go, my lad." This motherly advice was punctuated by Mrs. Upshot bobbing up and down so fast that she could have been harnessed to a sewing machine. Thank goodness for old mums, Vimes thought, as Feeney eventually got into the coach with a flask of hot tea, a spare pair of clean drawers, and half an apple pie. As the wheels started to turn, and after Feeney had finished waving to his old mum out the window, Vimes, balancing carefully against the rocking, lit the little spirit lamp that was all the coach had for illumination. He fell back into his seat again and said, "I'd be grateful, lad, if you would take some time to write down in your notebook everything I've said to you since I arrived this evening. It might be of assistance to both of us." Feeney practically saluted, and Vimes continued, "When we saw the dead Goblin Girl the other day, Mr. Feeney, did you make a note of that in your notebook?"
"Yes, sir,"
Feeney nearly saluted again. "My granddad told me always to write everything down in my notebook." They bounced in their seats as the coach hit a stone, and Vimes said quietly,
Did he ever tell you to accidentally sometimes turn over two pages at once, so that you had the occasional blank page?
Oh, no, sir, should I?
The seat bounced them up and down again, as Vimes said, Strictly speaking, lad, the answer is no, especially if you never work with me. Now, please, write it all down, just as I asked. And, since I'm not as young as you, I'm going to try and get some rest.
Yes, sir. I understand that, sir. Just one thing, sir. Mr. Stoner, the clerks, the magistrates, came to see me this afternoon and had a chat and said not to bother about the goblin girl because goblins are officially vermin. He was very kind and brought some brandy for my old mum, and he said that you were a fine gentleman but tended to get a bee in your bonnet, sir, what with being upper class and out of touch, sir. Sir? Sir? Have you gone to sleep, sir?
Vimes turned his head and in honeyed tones said, Did you make a note of that in your notebook, lad?
Oh, yes, sir.
And you still got in this coach with me? Why did you do that, Mr. Feeney? Stones rattled behind them, and it seemed some time before Feeney Upshot had assembled his thoughts to his satisfaction. He said,
Well, Commander Vimes, I thought, well, that Mr. Stoner, he's a knob, more or less, and so is Commander Vimes, only he's a duke, and is therefore a very big knob, and if you're going to get caught between knobs, maybe you'd better pick the biggest one to be on the side of.
He heard Vimes grunt, and continued, And then, sir, I thought, well, I was up there, I saw that poor creature and what had been done to her, and I remembered that Stoner had tried to make a fool out of me by making me arrest your good self, sir, and I thought about the goblins, and I thought, well, they're mucky and smelly, and the old goblin was crying, and animals don't cry, and goblins, well, they make stuff, beautiful stuff, and as for pinching our pig's fill and being generally mucky, we surely ain't short of humans round here who are pretty big in that respect. I could tell you some stories, and so I thought some more, and I thought, well, that Mr. Stoner, I thought he must have got it wrong.
There was a rumbling as the coach went over a bridge, and then the sound of wheels on packed flints was back.
Feeney said anxiously, Is that all right, sir?
He waited nervously, and then the voice of Vimes, and this time sounding rather far away, said,
Do you know what that little speech you made was called, Mr. Feeney?
Don't know, sir. It's just what I think.
It was called Redemption, Mr. Feeney. Hold on to it.
Vimes woke from a doze in which he had dreamed about young Sam playing a harp, and by the time he had understood that this was a dream, the noise of the coach wheels had changed as they slowed down and stopped. Willikins slid open the small slot that allowed discourse between passenger and coachman, and said quietly, Rise and shine, sir. We're about a quarter of a mile from Hangnails, population 37 and still stupid. And you can smell turkey from here, and wish you bloody well couldn't, excuse my catching. I surmise that it might be a good idea to walk quietly the rest of the way, sir.
Vimes got down from the coach and stamped the cramp out of his limbs. The air stank with the curiously invasive smell of birds. Not even goblins persecuted the sinuses one half so badly. But this was a tiny distraction compared with the thrill. Yes, the thrill. How long was it since he had led a dawn raid? Far too long, that's how long. And now captains and senior sergeants got the job while he stayed in the office, being the Ankh-Morpork City Watch. Well, not today. Whispering as they walked through the knee-high mist, he said, You, Chief Constable Upshot, you will hammer in the front door when I give you the signal, and I will be stationed outside the back door in case the gentleman does a runner, okay? They were nearing the property now, yes. They would just need the two of them. The farmhouse looked barely big enough to have two doors, let alone three.
What shall I say, Commander? Hissed Feeney.
Oh, blimey, you're the bloody son and grandson of coppers, my lad. What the hell do you think you should shout? Let me give you a clue. It does not include the word please. I'll give you a whistle when I'm in position. Got it? Good.
They walked, with care, across the stinking yard, and Vimes took up station around the back, where an interesting thought occurred to him, and he made a mental note. He then leaned against the dirty wall of the house, a little bit away from the back door, took a pinch of snuff to clear the air of turkey, and gave one faint whistle.
Open up, in the name of the law! You are surrounded! You have 1 minute to open the door, I mean it! Open the door, this is the police!
Leaning cosily against the wall, Vimes grudgingly rated that as pretty good for a beginner, with one point taken off for adding, I mean it. Then, as a man flew out of the back door, he stuck out his boot.
Good morning, sir. My name is Commander Vimes. I hope you're in a position to remember yours.
In the sheds, the turkeys were going insane, causing a slight rise in the smell. The man struggled to his feet, looking around desperately.
Oh, yes, you could run, yes, you could do that, said Vimes in a conversational tone of voice, but it might be thought by others that this might indicate that you knew you had some reason to run.
Now, personally, I would agree that anyone stopped by a copper should run like buggery, innocent or not, on first principles. Besides, we get so fat these days that we need the exercise. But do run if you want to, Mr. Flutter, because I can run too, and very fast. By now, Flutter was smiling the smile of a man who thinks that this copper is not very smart.
I bet you don't have a magistrate's warrant, do you?
Well, now, Mr. Flutter, why might you think that, eh? Perhaps you think the magistrates might not issue a warrant to arrest you, yes? By the way, thank you for showing me where the tobacco barrels are stored. Your cooperation will be taken into consideration. Some days are bad days, like when you stare right down into the mangled corpse of a young woman. Then you get good days when the suspect's darting eyes flashing across the yard show you exactly where the loot is hidden. I shall, of course, mention your cooperation to the authorities and, of course, in the local pub as well. Ah, yes. And now Mr. Flutter was visualising the result of being seen as some kind of grass, so stupidly he went for,
I never told you anything about any tobacco, and you know it, copper.
At this point, Feeney stepped around the corner with his fearsome club raised and a look of almost comical aggression on his face.
You want me to give him the old one too, Commander? Just say the word, Gov.
Vimes rolled his eyes in mock despair.
No need for that, Feeney, no need for that, just when Mr. Flutter here is so anxious to talk to us, understand?
Flutter decided the way forward was an appeal to Feeney.
Look, Feeney, you know me.
He got that far and no further because Feeney said,
It's Constable Upshot to you, Flutter. My dad had you up before the beaks 24 times. He used to call you the blue bottle on account of whenever there was a load of shit going on, he'd find you flapping about in it. And he told me to watch you, which is what I am doing right now, in fact.
He glanced at Vimes, who gave him an encouraging nod, and then said,
You see my problem, Mr. Flutter. We're not here to talk about contraband tobacco, okay? Now, I never saw myself as a revenuer, not a popular profession. I'm a copper pure and simple, right? And in my hand I have this man what is only doing a favour to his employer by storing a few barrels of tobacco in his shed. But on the other hand, well, if I found a murderer in the other hand, why, God bless you, I might totally forget all about the first hand. Don't ask me to draw you a picture, Flutter, because my hands are full.
Flutter looked aghast.
This is about that goblin, right? Look, it wasn't me. Okay, I'm a bit of a naughty boy. I put my hand up to that, but I ain't like him. I'm a scallywag, not a damn murderer.
Vimes looked at Feeney. Some people could be said to be as pleased as Punch. Feeney could be said to look as pleased as Punch, Judy, the dog Toby, the crocodile, and above all the policeman all rolled in together. Vimes raised his eyebrows in new interrogation, and Feeney said,
I believe him, Chief. He hasn't got it in him, I swear. The best he could manage would be knocking over an old lady for a purse, and even then she'd probably have to be blind too. There, you see, said Flutter triumphantly, I'm not really a bad person.
No, said Vimes, you're a veritable choir boy, Mr. Flutter, I can see that, and I'm rather religious too, and I like chapter and verse, but are you willing to swear that the individual known as Stratford knifed a goblin girl to death on Angman's Hill in the grounds of Ramkin Hall 3 nights ago? Flutter raised a finger.
Can I say that I told him to leave off when he laughed and I didn't know it was a girl neither? I mean, how can you tell?
Vimes's face was deadpan.
Tell me, Ted, what would you have done if you had known? I'm intrigued.
Flutter looked down at his feet.
Well, that's not right, know what I mean?
And you can find someone like this dangerous clown in nearly every neighbourhood, Vimes thought.
Clearly, chivalry is not dead, Mr. Flutter. Okay, Feeney, let's carry on. Mr. Flutter, why were you on Angman's Hill on the aforesaid night?
We were just having a walk, said Flutter. Vimes's face was again deadpan, so deadpan as to be mortified.
Of course you were, Mr. Flutter. Silly of me to ask the question, really.
Constable Upshot, I can see Willikins over there having a smoke. He pushed at the open door and dragged Flutter inside.
Does this building have a cellar?
Flutter was one step away from a toilet break, but nevertheless, being the kind of fool to dig himself in deeper, managed to sneer,
There might be, so what?
Mr. Flutter, I've already told you that I am a religious man, and since you would test the patience of a saint, I need to spend a moment in quiet contemplation, understand?
I'm sure you know that there's always an easy way, and then again, there's always the hard way. Currently, this is the easy way, but the hard way is also quite easy, in a manner of speaking. Before talking to you again, I want to be alone with my thoughts, and it occurs to me, Mr. Flutter, that you might have some thoughts about, as it were, legging it. And so my colleague, Chief Constable Upshot, will guard the door,
and I shall send in my Batman, Mr. Willikins, to keep you company.